1960s, Glasgow was a dancing mad city with crowds flocking to its many ballrooms. But for one young woman, a taxi ride home from a dance hall in October 1969 with a man she'd just met was destined to end in tragedy. As the cab made its way through the dark city streets, her fate was already sealed. It seemed she had been dancing with a killer.
There's no time.
O'clock.
Okay, here we are again. It's Tuesday and it's episode 88.
Damn, 88.
Right?
88 weeks of this.
Isn't that crazy?
Going by, huh?
Well, yeah.
Going by pretty fast.
Time keeps on slipping into the future.
And we have like almost 2,400 subscribers now. It just grew by natural means, you know?
I feel like the movie reviews have been a big help.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I do feel like people are kind of discovering the show through that. Although, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe it's just the topics we're doing.
Yeah, I think we need to shut down 13 o'clock at Menace. That was kind of like a waste. Maybe we'll take that material and just download it directly into the normal stream. Put that into a different playlist.
I've been thinking about doing that because you know how for our 100th episode, we're going to do like a big, super long kind of special edition.
Yeah.
And I thought as kind of an adjunct to that, that I would put all the 13 o'clock and minutes videos up around that same time too. It's kind of like a 100th episode celebration. So our 100th episode is going to go up, I think in July 17th or something like that. So kind of look out for that. I did start making all those 13 o'clock and minutes videos, but they took such a long time and they didn't really get a lot of hits.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of like, well, man, we should just do movie reviews because they're much easier.
Yeah. And they're not
as graphics intensive.
Right. And they're a more effective advertisement for the show.
Yeah. So I said, well, I'll just like probably just close down that as an extra channel and just put them in the regular stream. But I'll do that right around the July when we're doing our 100th episode. Now on this episode, since we've done like some paranormal, some unsolved mystery stuff like that, I was like, well, I want to get back to doing true crime.
Yeah.
So what we're doing today is we're talking about two British serial killers who have never been identified.
Okay.
Both of these serial killers are going to be in volume 2 of my book, The Faceless Villain. I'm going to talk about both of them in there. And I mean, these are like super weird cases. They're both from the 60s. And these are really two cases that I've always been kind of fascinated by. And maybe I get the feeling that maybe they're not that well known in the U.S.
All right.
So I kind of want to talk about those. And while we're talking about that, I've been working hard, as I said, on volume 2 of The Faceless Villain.
Yeah, it's almost done, actually.
Not really. Well
from my point of view, it is. You're like, what?
Well, I'm more than halfway done.
More than halfway.
That's for sure. But what I decided to do, once I got to the halfway point, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go back and dig deeper, make sure I didn't like forget some big shit like to put back in the first half of the book. And of course, I found a whole bunch of other shit because you guys, and I think I mentioned this before, you start looking into unsolved murders. There are so
many.
There are so many. And
I
really,
came up with an idea. She said, there's so many murders. So many murders. And I said, that should be the name of a book. So many murders.
You know what I should
do? That'd make a good title. After, so many murders.
After I'm done with the Faceless Villain trilogy, which I hope to have done by the end of this year, what I might do is just make like a clearinghouse book of like all the shit I forgot to put into these ones or the ones that I could have put in for whatever reason. And I'll just call it So Many Murders.
So many murders.
Well, like, here's the, like, I had to have some criteria. Like, I didn't want to put in ones that were like gang related or ones that were like, you know,
robberies.
Someone was murdered in the course of a robbery.
Yeah.
I didn't want to put in necessarily like political assassinations, you know, shit like that.
It has to be weird stuff.
Like, it has to be mysterious or creepy, you know, or random. Like, I usually find ones creepy that are like, you know, the girl gets off a bus and she's walking home and she just disappears and they find her body in a ditch like later on.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of wanted to stay within that. But even within those parameters, so many. It's like, so I had to start, you know, I made this humongous outline of like, I don't even know how many cases it is. It's a lot. And I just have to go through and I'm just taking out the ones that don't have a huge amount of information about them. Right. 'Cause I want to have some, you know, something like substantial to talk about. If there's only like three fucking sentences about some, like, oh, this poor woman was found in her house, like right. stabbed 35 times, you know, that's creepy, but you
what
know,
can you do with it?
I can't do anything with that. Yeah. So I kind of wanted to stick with stuff that there was a lot of information about.
Right.
So that should be out, like I said, early summer. I don't know, you know, the audiobook might take a little bit longer. That might be midsummer, but we'll see. I've been working on a lot the last few days, and I think I have the outline finalized. I'm just going to go and insert things. And like I said, these two cases are in there, and I've already written about these two. But before we get to that, let's first do our shout-outs. Last movie review was Phantasm. Yeah. So if you want to check that out, go and check that out if you haven't.
It's a popular movie.
Yeah.
Popular review.
Well, I figured we had to do that one. I mean, that's like a cult classic.
I cannot believe how many hits the Black Hole review has.
That must have fallen into that little gap where it's like a movie that a lot of people like, but not a lot of people have reviewed.
Yeah, I didn't expect that. Maybe.
Because I kind of feel like that happened with our Logan's Run kind of thing.
Right, yeah. Like Logan's Run got about 8,000, 7,000 views or something.
Because it was just something like, I remember. How that happened. Because they showed it on cable all the time, like back in the day.
Yeah, most of the ones we have only have like 300, 200, 300, maybe 400 views. But like every now and then you get ones like 7,000 out of the blue, 4,000.
Yeah. You know? It's just, you never really know which one's going to do that. I mean, like I said, I like to see like the cult movies.
Kind of like our subscribers. It took forever to get to about 1,000 subs and then went from 1,000 to 2,300 quickly. I guess you just go into new algorithms. People sharing.
Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously the more.
Hey, if you guys are sharing the show, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you to everybody that has shared the show around and, you know, recommended it to their friends.
We get all these comments, you know, on Facebook about how they can't believe that we don't have more subs than we have, you know, based on the quality of the show, you know, we can't control it. It just, you know, so it's all on you guys.
It's all your fault.
It's all your fault. You can't control it. It just, you know, subs do what it does.
Well, you know, we just turn on the microphone and kick around and if people want to listen to it, then they can listen to
just
it.
Just make it.
Cool.
And there they go.
I honestly, when we first started the show, I didn't think anyone would listen to it.
And, you know, some people have said that, you know, some people have told us in private that this is we're their favorite, like, paranormal / mystery variety show. I don't understand it. You know, they got people that I look at the show and I'm like, people watch that? And they got like 123,000 subs. And they're like, you know, well, she does have boobs. You know what I mean? There's some girls that just put a camera on themselves, you know, in their trailer somewhere, and they got 123,000 subs.
I have boobs too. Maybe I should just put a camera on my boobs.
Yeah, probably.
For the whole show.
The problem is that to have
I don't want to do that.
The problem, you know, and I've tried to explain this to some people who have commented, say, why don't you guys do it, you know, live stream? The problem with live stream is that the show that you get from us is actually heavily edited.
Well, not heavily.
Well, we cut out a lot of dead space.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we're like, oh, shit, what do we have to talk about next?
Well,
oh, yeah.
That's just because we're getting old and senile.
Right.
And sometimes I can't remember what word I want to use or I forget a fact. So I have to go
to Wikipedia, check it out. Right.
And stuff like that. You know, I like the way that our show is like freewheeling.
Right.
But that also entails that sometimes I'm going to forget shit and I'm going to like go back and fix it.
And, you know, we're at the point now where we don't want to put out misinformation or disinformation. So
although we probably still do.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll say something. Well, wait a minute. Is that true? Because that just came out of my mouth. Wait, let's see if that's true.
Or it came out of your ass.
Yeah, it came out of my ass. It says, okay, it did true. We see, my memory is such a vast wealth, you know what I mean, of knowledge, that sometimes I can't remember what I remember.
I know that
feeling. You know what I'm talking about? Something will come out and go, how do I know that? Where did that come from? I have a feeling that that's right.
Yeah.
And then I'll check it, and it is right.
Yeah.
But I can't tell you how I got that information.
Because you're like plugged into the ether, man. The Crustal Sphere.
It's the Crustal Sphere.
All the information is coming from the Crustal Sphere.
But I think a lot of people are like that as soon as you hit 40, you know, when you're older than 40. You know a bunch of shit, but you can't remember how you know it.
You can't remember how you know it.
How you know. It's just stuff that you've recorded.
Well, because, I mean, considering over my 45 years, I've probably read about 40 bajillion books.
Yeah.
So I'm going to remember all kind of facts and not have any idea how I know that. Or even if I just made it up. Maybe I dreamed it.
Maybe you dreamt it. You don't know. Gotta go check.
I don't know. But
for the most part, our show is accurate. It's not perfect, But it's pretty accurate.
But like I said, don't kill me if it's not, because right. sometimes I fuck some shit up.
Right. That's just how it goes.
Yeah.
I mean, all shows are like that.
Yeah. Anyways, we went off on another tangent.
Yeah,
but yeah, go watch Phantasm.
Go watch
also,
Phantasm.
If you want to support the show, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/13oclockpodcast or go to our blog, which is 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com.
Yeah, share
and
us on Facebook.
A link in the sidebar to a PayPal account. Also, thank you to our newest patron, whose name is Anthony.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you, Anthony. You rock. All right. Now, before we get into the main topic, I have three little bitty news stories. They're
That's
not
right.
crime stories. These were just ones that I found online.
Gotta put in the news, put in the news.
That's
doing
nice.
The news. I should do a news song.
I was going to say, you should do that every week now.
Doing the news. Do
Huey in the news.
sing that shit like dancing. Here's news.
Actually, I like that better.
I'm not in the mood.
You're not in the mood for singing like that?
Nah,
like, okay.
I'm not in the mood.
Maybe I'll Next record time. You when you're in the shower. And then
yeah.
Can do that.
I'll do the news song.
Yeah, do the news song in the shower. So these were just three little news paragraphs that I found on some fucking News of the Weird site that I thought were
yeah.
entertaining. Okay, so this first one is from Alabama.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Alabama?
Already.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And it happened on February 12th. Now,
right.
this woman named Beverly Harrison, who's a 62-year-old woman, her family, her relatives come over, and they bring her a present. It's a ham.
Okay.
Which, you know, free
that's
ham.
How you, yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
It's a southern thing to do. You give out food.
Yeah. For some reason, I don't know if she was just like, fuck that ham.
Yeah.
I'm allergic to ham.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was. She waits till her relatives leave. Then she takes the ham, puts it in a trash can at the hotel where she was living, and set it on fire.
What?
And then she took her dog out for a walk without telling anybody that there was a fire in this garbage can. And later on, like I guess no one noticed,
yeah.
the ham exploded.
What? No, come on. Come on. Come on. I'm trying to put this together.
Yes. As a result, this is what the news
okay,
story
okay.
says. She goes out to walk her dog because
okay.
she's just like, I'm going to, it was kind of like blowing up a car and walking away from it in slow motion, except
okay.
it was setting a ham
yeah.
on fire and putting it in a trash can and then walking your
you
dog.
You know you're a bad motherfucker when something blows up behind you, you're going to turn around and look.
Yeah.
Just,
so it says she went out to walk her dog. As a result, and this is a quote, she was spared from being a victim of the later explosion of charred bits of ham that blew out the front wall of the room.
I don't believe this.
Well, when a nearby can of butane fuel was ignited. So there was a can of fuel. It wasn't the,
okay,
it wasn't
the
ham
blew
that
up.
Exploded.
All right, there's some
well,
butane.
The ham did blow up. It's just, it wasn't the...
It was the source of the explosion.
It wasn't the source of the...
The
blood.
Ham was blown up by the
by
butane.
By the butane fuel.
Okay.
Yes. So, exploding hams, y'all.
Okay.
I don't know why.
Well...
Why?
Well, we need more
information. A
62-year-old
woman.
What hotel was this? Do they name it?
It's actually called the Bomar. Is it Bomar?
Okay, I'm
Bomar Inn in Athens, Alabama.
Okay, I'm picturing it as one of those ones like Dan Bell would go visit.
Yeah, that's what I was picturing
yeah.
also.
Which is, you know, a single-story, trashy hotel that's
yeah.
it's a C-shaped and it goes around a
like
pool.
Yeah, like a big parking lot.
And the pool is a stagnant pool.
With mosquitoes
with
in
mosquitoes
it.
In
yeah.
it. And that's a bunch of crackheads and rockheads. Probably what happens, they kick this woman out on her own. You got to live in a motel. We can't live with you. Then they come and they
you
bring her a ham.
Exploding hams.
Here's your ham, right? Then they leave, right? And she's like, fuck your ham. You know? And she throws it, you know, she throws it in the garbage can and then throws it, sets it on fire. You know what I mean? Out of spite. Well, there was some gas down in there.
Because some women just want to watch the ham burn.
Yeah. I'm experienced with gas.
Yeah, no shit.
Okay, all right.
All right,
what's
so she's actually in jail now for arson.
Yo!
So she could face life in prison if convicted.
So they won't get a
for
conviction.
For just blowing up a ham.
They won't get convicted.
Yeah, arson.
An accident.
All right, so that was the first story.
Right.
Now the second story, this took place on Easter Sunday. This happened in Phoenix. Phoenix mom, Sharon Dobbins, was determined to get her two teenage sons, out of bed for Easter services.
Yeah.
On Sunday, April 1st.
This is going to be bad.
First.
What state was this again?
Arizona. Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay, yeah. They're crazy over there, too.
Yeah. So one of them says, nah, I don't want to go to church for Easter. It's too early. I want to sleep in.
Yeah.
Now, what would a regular mom do? Just kind of yell at them.
Yeah.
Just, you know, just kind of get them. Or just say, fuck it, you can stay here.
Yeah.
Okay, that is not what this mom did. This mom tased his ass.
Oh, yeah. 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 Okay, I'm seeing it now. I know what kind of... Now, what was it, an actual taser or was it a stun gun?
She had...
There's a big difference.
Evidently, it's a taser.
Okay, because a taser,
It says grabbed a taser.
Let me explain this to the audience.
Okay.
A taser is a non-lethal weapon. It's much like a pistol. It uses blanks to fire needles out. And the needle has some electric leads on it. Goes into you, hooks into you, and when you pull a trigger, it shocks the shit out of you.
Yeah.
Now, that's a taser. A stun gun just looks like a television remote control on it. With a couple of prongs on the end of it. It's like a cattle prod. I'm wondering maybe she just hit him with a stun gun.
I don't
know.
Not
a taser.
It says taser.
It says taser. That means she shot him with
some
needles.
It says specifically taser, and it has a capital T and everything.
Okay. Then that's what she did. Tased
so she tased
out of the voice.
Now, the 16-year-old wasn't playing that. And called the cops.
Right. Okay.
And she was totally not even embarrassed about it. She was like, the news came. She told the news, quote, I said, get up. It's Jesus's day.
Yeah.
So I'm going to call and tase your ass
to
get out of bed.
They were bad.
Yeah. So she got arrested for child abuse.
Yeah. They were bad.
Not surprisingly. She says, as Dobbins explained thereafter, quote, all I was trying to do is tell my kids to put God first.
Okay.
That's a good story.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know.
Put some discipline in them.
Go to church. If your mom tells you to, or she might tase you. All right.
That's Arizona, man.
Yeah, fucking Arizona. That's like, it's second only to Florida, I think, for weird news stories.
I just, you know, this is to our UK listeners and to our Australian listeners. This is fucking America. Okay. Somebody tells you to do some shit, you might get tased if you don't do it. We don't know.
We are balls deep in insanity over there. We don't even know.
We bring it. Okay.
There's some crazy.
You got to understand who you're dealing with.
Yeah. All right. So the third and final story. This one's actually kind of more creepy than funny. A 23-year-old Selena woman arrived at her home around 9:30 p.m. on Thursday, March 29th. To find that the front door had been locked and chained from the inside. Never a good sign. She called the police, who searched the home and found no one there. But 2 hours later, her ex-boyfriend's legs punched through the ceiling in her living room.
Oh, shit.
Tyler Bergkamp was his name.
All right.
Police arrested him and took him to the Salina Regional Health Center to recover from his fall. As he fell through the fucking ceiling.
Damn.
Was he like a fat ass or was this not a good ceiling? I don't know. I don't know what he looked like.
Well,
5 days later, he left the hospital and broke into another woman's house.
Yeah.
Where he left his hospital gown, exchanging it for one of her t-shirts and a pair of sneakers.
Yeah.
They don't say anything about pants. So, I don't know. It seems to me that if you're trying to escape from the cops and you break into somebody's house to take their clothes, it's probably less conspicuous to be running around in a hospital gown than it is to be running around in a women's t-shirt and women's shoes with no pants on.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. Maybe he did have pants.
For some reason, this case kind of reminds me of another case that happened here in the United States. This is probably 10, 15 years back. They had some boy. This is in one of the more rural areas. Boy came up missing. They looked for him, never could find him. He was a teenager, probably about 16, 17, 18, around that time. Well, a few miles from where he lived, there was a house that had been sitting there vacant for a long time, like 5, 6 years. Somebody bought it. And they were in that house for months. Winter came. They went to go make a fire in the fireplace. And all the smoke started filling up the house.
Uh-oh.
They put the fire out, you know, and they were trying to figure out why the chimney wasn't ventilating. And there he was, that missing boy, stuck in that chimney.
God,
dead.
Like,
he'd been
like
dead in there for a long time.
That's like that story from Gremlins that she told about her dad dressed up as Santa getting stuck in the chimney.
Yeah, they think they figure what happened was when that house was abandoned, he tried to get into it by shimmying down the chimney. Got stuck. And was alive in there for a long time.
Well, yeah, I guess
until he died of starvation, or not starvation, but thirst.
Yeah,
so probably about 7 days.
Yeah.
Couldn't go back up and couldn't get back down. Just
That's
stuffed
horrible.
In that. Bad
Don't
way of going.
Ever try to break into a house when you're going down the chimney. I would
Moral of the story. If you're going to break into a house, glass. Break the glass.
Break the glass.
Just break the glass.
Pro tip.
Yeah, pro tip. It's not as loud as you think it is. Break the fucking glass.
That way you have a method of egress.
That's right.
You're not going to get stuck in the fucking chimney. Yeah, so that's horrible. So, yeah, this guy, obviously, they did catch him later on, and he faces a number of charges.
Damn.
One of which is being a dumbass, which isn't illegal, but it probably should be. All right, so now let's get to the main topic, now that we're fucking 20 minutes into this shit.
We're padding out the show.
No,
it's an extra long show.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what we do.
We go over a couple times. And
like I said, I did actually, I did get a couple of complaints that like, oh, we're 18 minutes in and we still haven't gotten to the main topic the last one, but I just like deleted them. I'm like, man, really? Shut up.
No, they can go.
Well, and honestly, on the last episode, I think it was 26 minutes in before we started talking about the main topic, I put a note in the description that said, hey, if you just want to hear about Poorly Rectory, go to 26 minutes, because that's when we started talking about it. Before that, we like went off on our kind of digression,
Let me say something to the audience. We value our audience, okay? But we're going to do the show the way we feel like doing it at the time. That's how it is.
And like I said, if
we got at least 2,400 subs right now.
Yeah.
We can't make them all happy.
Yeah.
There's always going to be a few people that say, I don't like this, I don't like that. But in general, people like the show.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's get to the main thing. Now, the first serial killer that I want to talk about is not Jack the Ripper, but Jack the Stripper.
Oh, shit.
This is actually kind of an infamous unsolved serial murder series. They think he started killing in 1959, although that they're not really sure if it's the same guy. But this is also known as the Hammersmith Nude Murders.
Right. Okay.
And they never caught this guy. There's not really much of an idea who could have done it. So let's kind of lay out the thing. Now, the first victim that they think might have been him, this happened in 1959. And the woman's name was Elizabeth Figg. She was 21 years old. She was a prostitute. This is why they called him Jack the Stripper, because he mainly targeted prostitutes, same as Jack the Ripper did. And it was in London right around the Thames.
But prostitutes aren't strippers, are they?
No, but no, they call him Jack the Stripper because most of the bodies were found naked.
Oh, okay. He's taking clothes
That's
off.
That's why.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
He killed prostitutes
He
and
killed
strippers.
Prostitutes and stripped them.
There
yes.
you go.
So
now it's making sense.
Yeah. Okay. So Elizabeth Figg, 21 years old. She was from Cheshire originally. They found her dead on a towpath on the banks of the River Thames on June 17th, 1959. She had been strangled. Her clothes, she wasn't completely naked, but she had been, her top was torn open so that her breasts were exposed. Her shoes and underwear were missing. All of her personal belongings were gone. Now, they thought at the time that maybe she had been picked up by a client and that she had taken off her underwear and shoes in the car, you know, in the course of the transaction. Let's call it that.
We call it a trick here in the United States.
Yeah, and that he had subsequently killed her and dumped her off. So they figured that she had probably been killed between midnight and 2 a.m. And when they were canvassing the neighborhood, they found that a couple who owned a nearby pub said they saw a car. They saw headlights of a car at a little past midnight and what sounded like a woman screaming, although they didn't really investigate because I guess that happens a lot around there. I don't know. Okay, so they're not sure if this was the same guy. It might have been, but it was 4 years before another murder would happen that they thought was the serial killer. But they think maybe that was his kind of early, one of his early crimes. The next one that was similar didn't take place until November 8th. 1963, that's when the body was found. Now, there were some workers, and they were at a dump in London on the south side of the Thames. They found a really decomposed body buried under 2 feet of garbage. She was totally naked, except for one nylon stocking that had been rolled down to her ankle, almost like somebody did it on purpose. Now, the truck that had found the body had actually cut her head off.
Huh.
They said several of her teeth were gone, too, but they're not really sure if the truck did that or if the killer did that.
Right.
But they're pretty sure that the truck cut the head off. Now, they're not sure how she was killed, although they could tell from, you know, the hyoid bone that probably she had been strangled, just like the first lady in 1959 had been. She was actually not identified at first. She wasn't identified until almost 20 days later when they matched her fingerprints with ones that were already on file. So then they found out that this woman was also a prostitute. She was 22 years old, and her name was Gwyneth Rees. She was from Wales originally, and she also worked under several different aliases. which a lot of them did at the time.
Right.
So this one, they're not sure if this was Jack the Stripper either, but it kind of sounds like it was, especially the thing with the stocking and everything, because a lot of the later ones had that same detail. Now, she had last been seen alive on September 29th, and she was seen getting into a car that witnesses thought was a Ford Zephyr or a Ford Zodiac. Now, interestingly, one of her pimps, they didn't really call them pimps. They were somebody that procured clients for them, right. I guess. But he had a Ford Zephyr.
All right.
And when they searched his car, they found some of Gwyneth's blood in it. But he admitted to beating her up on several occasions. Right. His name was Cornelius Whitehead.
All right.
So they couldn't really, but he said, you know, I did beat her up a few times, you know, because she was a hooker and he was trying to get money out of her or whatever, but he says he didn't kill her.
Right.
And they couldn't prove it, you know.
It's a process called putting your pimp hand down.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's called, putting your pimp hand down.
Sometimes a pimp has to unholster his .45 caliber pimp hand and lay it down on a hoe.
Do you know what would be really funny? If I took you doing that voice and put it over like an old 50s style...
Like a training film.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying. Like the ones they do on shorts on MST3K.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And you can have like the little kind of... little pimp cartoon.
Sure.
It's like teaching you how to be a pimp.
Yeah.
Exactly. How to be a pimp, but 1950s style. Yeah. So they couldn't really prove that he was the killer. There were a couple other suspects, Reggie and Ronnie Cray, who were actually very famous gangsters in the UK at that time. They were suspected. They were questioned, but they wouldn't say anything. They couldn't get anything out of them. One of their associates, George Dixon, was also questioned. They didn't have enough to hold him either. And, I mean, for this murder, I have to say, I think a lot of times, maybe in the U.S., when a prostitute gets murdered, I don't know how stringently they investigate.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they do, maybe they don't. I guess it depends on the jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But in this case, when Gwyneth Reese was killed, even though she was a prostitute, I mean, they didn't fuck around. They interviewed thousands of people. They, like, just, you know, they went all out.
Right. Now, it's not anything against the United States, just that some of these jurisdictions are heavily overworked. I mean, there are murders happening right now they got to worry about, you know.
And, yeah, and we were talking about this yesterday because I was talking about how, and this is something that I only just discovered yesterday when I was researching other cases to put in my book. Do you know, back in 1965, when the FBI first started keeping these types of records, the percentage of murders that were cleared, meaning someone was arrested and put on trial. I don't know if it necessarily means the person was convicted or not, but it means that someone was arrested and put on trial for the murder. That rate was 90% in 1965.
Yeah.
In 2012, it was 64%.
Right.
So despite all of the forensic technology that we have at our disposal now, for some reason, there are way more unsolved crimes.
Yeah. Right.
And they seem like they're piling up.
Right.
It seems like if they don't solve something in the first
24, 48 hours,
then it's pretty much not going to get solved. Although there are a handful of cases of ones that were solved many, many years later, which, you know, that's nice and everything.
But a lot of times what happens in the criminal world is that somebody gets knocked off. There are no suspects. Case goes cold. If they don't have a suspect within 48 hours, chances are that's a wrap. Then 4 or 5 years later, somebody gets pinched. Or they get squeezed and they end up in jail or prison for a lesser crime. They know who killed that person. And they say, look, cops, I'll tell you who committed that murder 4 years ago if you let me out. Then they go back and, you know, they get that guy. That's how a lot of those unsolved murders are actually solved. They're solved in what's called prison snitches.
Yeah. Well, the problem, too, that I came across researching cases, and particularly in these cases, is because... these people, these killers, are targeting just random women.
Yeah.
And some of them, in the case of Jack the Stripper, he was targeting marginalized women. They were prostitutes. You don't know. I mean, they have so many clients. They have so many associates. There's really, you know, where do you start?
Right.
And I think that happened with a lot of the cases that I was researching from the book, too, even ones that weren't necessarily serial killers. But I mean, you know, if there's just some 10-year-old girl walking down the street or riding her bike to the store one day and somebody just grabs her, puts her in a car and kills her and throws her in a ditch, there's no relationship between him and her.
Yeah.
So where do they begin?
Well, you know, there's this weird perception of law and order, which sometimes really isn't there. I get to say the criminal justice system and law enforcement aren't as effective as people tend to believe it is.
And though I should say that even though the rate of unsolved murders is higher, the actual number of murders is lower. Has actually gone down since the 80s or 90s.
And we were talking about that earlier. I think it's environmental. It's environmental.
It might be.
One of my theories has to do with the leaded fuel. Leaded fuel came out for a while, and I think cars were blowing lead out of the exhaust pipes.
Yeah.
And it collected up inside cities over the decades. And I think people were inhaling it. And you know that lead causes people to do crazy shit, including be violent. Well, leaded fuel, they started phasing out in the 80s, and it seems like maybe the lead is blowing away. I don't know. That's just my crazy idea.
Because in the 90s, the crime rate started going precipitously downward.
Yeah.
At least in the U.S.
Maybe all that built-up lead particles are being, you know, washed away through by rains.
It's possible. And I suppose it might be a contributing factor, sure.
People die off, and new people are born, and they're not as poisoned, you know, from lead because they didn't live in a high lead environment.
Yeah.
That's just what I was thinking.
Yeah, it could be.
And it always seems to be in a urban environment too, where the traffic is.
Yeah.
You know, and you have historians say, you know, these ancient Romans, they did crazy shit because of lead poisoning. You know, they were eating off of lead plates. They had lead pipes. And
yeah.
I think they said they had lead pipes. So I know that they were eating off of lead silverware.
Yeah.
And that maybe that's driving them crazy. But, you know, they don't ever mention leaded fuel that was being burned at that time.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good idea to put lead in fuel.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
Make those valves more quieter in your car, but not a good idea.
No. Anyway, so Gwyneth Rees, even though it kind of seemed like maybe her pimp did it, Cornelius Whitehead.
Yeah.
Now, she had an associate who was also a prostitute. Her name was Brenda Mia. And she said, you know, I saw Gwyneth getting into the car, like on the last day she was seen. And she was like, that is not Cornelius's car.
Yeah.
So now they're thinking, like I said, Gwyneth Rees, she was the second murder. And she's usually considered a possible Jack the Stripper. They're not entirely sure if it was him or if it was someone else. But the next one, that one was definitely attributed to Jack the Stripper. This happened on February 2nd. There were two brothers, George and Douglas Capon, I guess is how you pronounce it. They were members of the Corinthian Sailing Club, and they were getting ready for a boat race on the Thames. And they, you know, were getting their boat ready, and then they saw a woman's body kind of lying half in and a half out of the water on the banks of the Thames. And this victim also found completely naked, except for her nylons rolled down to her ankles. So they took the body out of the river, and she also had missing teeth. She had bruising around her jaw. They said that could have been from falling, or she could have been assaulted at some earlier date.
Now, the missing teeth were busted out from punches, or were they just missing?
Yeah, they're not real sure. Because, like I said, Gwyneth Rees, the one that was found in the garbage pile, her teeth were missing too, but they're not sure if the truck did that or if, like, the killer did that.
Interesting.
So, yeah, that's another thing. She had eaten a full meal shortly before her death. She had died probably about 2 to 7 days before her remains were discovered. No trace of alcohol or drugs in the system. Now, this was an interesting thing, though. There was fluid in her lungs, like water in her lungs, that was consistent with drowning. So they were kind of like, maybe it was an accident.
No.
However, then they looked down in her throat and found a pair of her own semen-stained underwear crammed down in her throat. So obviously she had not drowned, even though, you know, there was enough water in her lungs
what he did was he beat her senseless. He thought that she was dead. He shoved that down her throat and threw her in the water.
And then she drowned.
And then she drowned, but she was, you know, unconscious.
Yeah. So this was another woman. They didn't know who it was straight away. They fingerprinted her, and then they matched her to a woman named Hannah Tailford. She was 31 years old, also a prostitute and a petty criminal. And she was originally from Northumberland. Now, the first investigation into this, they actually questioned her common law husband, who was known as either William Ewing or Alan Lynch. They'd been living together for about 8 years. He said that the last time he saw her was on January 24th at 9 p.m. And he said she went out, they had a flat, and she went out and she was going to work. Now, he said, I didn't know she was a prostitute, even though they've lived together for 8 years. She said, I thought she just worked the night shift at some cafe.
Oh, which, she was working the night.
Yeah, she was working the night shift, yeah. All right? Yeah. But so I don't know if he just made that up or whatever. But he said, I always thought she just had a job at an all-night cafe. I didn't know she was a prostitute. He says that was the last time he saw her, January 24th. However, a bunch of other witnesses came forward and said that they saw her between January 24th and February 1st, which was the day before her body was found. The people that lived downstairs from Alan Lynch and Hannah Tailford said that on February 1st, like early morning, that they had heard footsteps on the stairs and the sound of a woman screaming. Although Alan Lynch says that's bullshit because there were no women in the house on that date. Now, they had another acquaintance of theirs named Thomas Trice, and he said that Alan Lynch gave him a pair of shoes and some articles of clothing that were Hannah's, and he handed them to him and he said, get rid of these. So Thomas Trice handed them over to the cops, and he said when they got the shoes, they were kind of muddy.
Yeah.
But they were unable to match the mud to the mud on the Thames where the body was found. So they weren't real sure. So this could have been her husband, but I don't know.
Right.
So they said, because they said that he seemed really upset that she was dead and he cooperated. Right. He did lie detector tests and all that kind of shit. He cooperated with Scotland Yard. He answered all the questions and stuff like that. So same kind of thing. There's a huge thousands of people interrogated. They searched the area. There was a place called Duke's Meadows. They think that was where her body got dumped. Several weeks later, on February 19th, a blue coat that was later identified as Hannah's was found caught in the propeller of a boat on the Thames. So this was the same coat that she had been seen wearing the last time she was seen alive. So like I said, it's weird because the inquest, even though she had underwear stuffed down her throat, there were still some arguing at the coroner's inquest that maybe it was an accident or maybe she committed suicide or something like that.
Yeah.
So the coroner's jury actually ended up leaving the verdict open, which I thought was bizarre because obviously it was a murder.
Sounds like the cops didn't want an unsolved murder.
Maybe not. They
didn't want that on the books.
And, you know, so, and it's just weird because then later on that year, there would be, you know, another two women turning up dead in the same, you know, method. And actually, we're going to take a break right now, and then I'll get into that when we come back. So we will be back in just a couple of minutes.
There are terrors, real and imaginary, and I write about them all. Paranormal nonfiction, horror fiction, the Rochdale House Poltergeist, the Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, the Associated Monsters, Red Menace, the Tenebrist, Poisons. Bellwether. Go to www.jennyashford.com or search Amazon for the Jenny Ashford author page.
The Unseen Hand, a new exploration of poltergeist phenomena by Jenny Ashford, author of The Rochdale Poltergeist, House of Fire and Whispers, and The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. The Unseen Hand is a comprehensive collection of over 100 reported poltergeist cases from the first century to the present day. All the best known cases are presented, from the Bell Witch to Jeff the Talking Mongoose, from Rosenheim to Tina Resch, from Enfield to The Entity. A large selection of fascinating and lesser-known accounts from all over the world are also included, and all contain testimony from the most eerie and extraordinary events. The Unseen Hand is the ultimate compendium for readers interested in poltergeist disturbances throughout history and the theories behind what causes them. On sale now from Amazon in print, ebook, and audiobook formats. Go to Unseen Hand Book on Facebook and visit www.jennyashford.com for more information.
The Villisca Axe Murders, Hinterkaifeck Farm, The Axeman of New Orleans, The Cleveland Torso, Who Put Bella in the Witch Hour, The Solder Chimneys, The Phantom Killer, The Black Dahlia, Somerton. What is it about these unsolved murders that still fascinates us long after the cases have gone cold? Is it simply that we enjoy being able to come up with our own theories about what happened to the unfortunate victims? Or are we intrigued by the terrifying possibility that the killers are still out there somewhere? Take a grisly journey through the blood-soaked avenues of early 20th century crime in the new book, The Faceless Villain, Volume 1, by Jenny Ashford. Now available on Amazon.
Okay, and we're back. During the break, I realized that when I was talking about Hannah Tailford's murder, I think I said that it was February 1964. It's actually February 1963.
Okay.
So, you know, don't hate. I was just looking at the wrong thing. Okay, so then comes April of 1963. And here's two more women turn up dead. First one, April 8th, 26-year-old Irene Lockwood. They found her also on the banks of the Thames. She was found right in between where Elizabeth Figg had been found in 1959 and where Hannah Tailford was found in February of 1963. Now, same deal with Irene Lockwood as Hannah Tailford. She was also found naked, no obvious fatal wounds. She had a deep cut on her shoulder, but they think that might have happened after she died, like from a boat propeller. There were traces of semen found in her mouth and her vagina, but it did not appear that she'd been sexually assaulted, so that might have just been from her last client or whatever. And also, same deal, it was determined that her cause of death was drowning, although they thought that she was probably unconscious when she was put into the river. I don't think there was anything stuffed into her mouth or anything like that. It was almost like somebody knocked her out and then threw her in there and she drowned.
Then he choked her out.
Yeah.
And threw her in there.
She was also 4 months pregnant.
Ooh.
The last time she had seen, she was seen at a pub in Chiswick at around 8 p.m. on the evening of April 7th. So that was like the night before she was found. And, you know, she was pretty much the same profile as the other victims. She was originally from Nottingham and worked as a prostitute petty thief since she was 19. She had had a son in 1958, but she had given him away. The interesting thing about Irene was that about a year before she was murdered, she had been friends with this other prostitute who was named Vicky Pender. Now, Vicky Pender was found murdered in Islington in March of 1963. The main suspect in that murder was a guy named Colin Fisher, who was kind of big on the underground pornography type of trade. Now, he knew Vicky Pender, obviously, that's why he murdered her. He also knew Irene Lockwood, although he knew her as Sandra. So Irene Lockwood, I think, from what I've read about this case, kind of blew Colin Fisher's alibi, because he said, oh, well, when Vicky Pender got murdered, I was living with Irene Lockwood. And Irene Lockwood said, no, you weren't, motherfucker.
Huh.
So, you know, so then Vicky turned up dead. And then, like I said, Irene turned up dead. So Colin Fisher, they're not really sure about that. He was actually convicted of Vicky Pender's murder. So he was spent life in prison and he died in prison. Now, another person that they were looking at in Irene Lockwood's murder, they were looking through her apartment and they found a purse and it had a business card that had a phone number on it and it had the name Kenny. So they actually traced this back to a 57-year-old guy named Kenneth Archibald, and he was a handyman at this tennis club. And at first he said, no, I don't know that woman. But then somebody else that works at the club's like, yeah, you do. It's like she comes to parties here all the time and you know her. So then later on, like there would be more shit with him later on. But before that happened, there was another murder. So this other prostitute named Helen Barthelemy, she was 22, and they found her on April 24th. Now, they didn't find her in the Thames this time. She was actually in an alley not that far from the river. She had also been strangled, you know, very similar to Elizabeth Figg and Gwyneth Rees from 1959 and 1963. But the interesting thing about her body was that they found little chips of automotive paint on the body. And they thought that this had come from like a workplace or a factory. And that's probably where the killer was keeping the bodies before he was dumping them. Now, before they kind of look too much into that, here comes Kenneth Archibald. He wanders drunkenly into a police station in Notting Hill. And he says, I killed Irene Lockwood. I pushed her into the river. So they arrested him and they put him on trial in June of 1964. But when they got him on the stand, he said, no, I didn't do that. I just made that up. I was drunk and everything like that. So he enters a plea of not guilty. So, you know, they do the investigation. They're like, well, there's really no, other than this business card that she had in her purse, there's no physical evidence tying him to the murder. I mean, other than him just walking drunk ass into Notting Hill and saying, yeah, I killed her. So they had to let him go. Now, 3 weeks after that, they found another naked body of another prostitute. She was 30 years old. Her name was Mary Fleming. They found her in a sitting position outside of a garage in Chiswick. She had last been seen on July 11th, though her body wasn't found until the 14th. She was also strangled. She also had flakes of car paint on her skin. So at this point, all of these women turning up dead, even though a lot of them have other kind of promising suspects, you know, the method in which they're all killed, the method in which they're all found pretty much in a similar location. A lot of them are naked with their nylons rolled down and stuff like that. So they kind of think this is probably one guy and this is a serial killer. Now, the last one that they think that he killed, that happened on February 16th, 1965. And this was another prostitute. Her name was Bridget O'Hara. She was 28 years old. And she was actually found in a storage shed behind this thing called the Heron Trading Estate. Now, she was also strangled and she had paint flakes on her skin. Now, the paint flakes matched some paint flakes they found inside this building. So they're determining if this is a serial killer, this is either where he works or this is where he's storing the bodies before dumping them in the river. Because this was like this kind of industrial automotive paint. So since they had kind of narrowed that down and that's where the paint is coming from, they focused in on this one particular suspect. His name was Mungo Big John Ireland. Because why not?
Okay.
So he was a Scottish fella and he worked at the Heron Trading Estate. So they were like, well, it's got to be him because, you know, obviously. They're trying to build a case against him. He's Jack the Stripper. But less than a month after Bridget O'Hara's body was found, Mungo Ireland committed suicide by asphyxiating himself with carbon monoxide in his car.
Huh.
March the 3rd, he died. He left a note for his wife.
Yeah.
And part of it said, I can't stick it any longer. To save you and the police looking for me, I'll be in the garage.
Huh.
And he's dead. So they don't know if he was Jack the Stripper or not. Although the automotive paint would kind of suggest, you know, maybe. Although it's weird because even though to me he seems like the most likely suspect, when you're doing searches for Jack the Stripper or the Hammersmith Nude Murders, as they're also called, the main suspect that comes up is this guy named Freddie Mills, who was like a pretty famous boxer at the time. Apparently, in the kind of gangster British criminal underworld, they were pretty sure that Freddie Mills was Jack the Stripper. They said it was like kind of a known quantity.
Right.
They thought he was like kind of a sexual sadist. And so among the criminal underground, they're saying we thought it was this boxer.
Right.
Now, in July of 1965, Mills also died. They think it was suicide. It was self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Right.
Although it might have been an execution.
Now,
not entirely sure. They think it might be a suicide.
When Mungo asphyxiated himself, did the murder stop?
Yeah.
That's pretty.
But like I said, they're not sure. They think Bridget O'Hara was the last one.
Right. These guys don't stop until they die.
Right.
Or are captured. So I would say it's probably Mungo.
So, yeah, Mungo died. But like I said, Freddie Mills, who was another main suspect, he also died later on.
But it was over a year later, though.
But I think it was over a year later.
I don't think he could have held out for a year.
And, you know, there were some other suspects, too. There was this book that came out called Jack of Jumps by David Seabrook. And he thought that... or at least he said in the book that a lot of senior investigators at the time thought the killer was actually a cop, that it was a police detective named Andrew John Cushway. Although I'm not really entirely sure. I haven't read the book. I'm not entirely sure why people thought that it was him. I mean, he had been arrested, but for like breaking and entering, like little shit. It wasn't murder or anything.
To me, it sounds like something really mundane.
Yeah.
Not so much a Gary Ridgway type guy.
Yeah.
But just some thug that liked hookers, didn't want to pay.
Yeah.
Beat him to death, you know, got off on that, strip the clothes off of him, throw them and the clothes in the water. You know, nothing complicated, really.
Probably not. One of the other main suspects that is usually put forward is this guy named Harold Jones. He was from Wales. Now, he was actually convicted in 1921, when he was 15 years old, of killing two little girls. And he got a life sentence, but he only served 20 years, and then he got released on good behavior.
I remember this case.
Yeah. So he actually, they thought that he did move to London in 1947 with his wife and daughter. So he was probably living there at the time. the Hammersmith nude murders were kind of similar to the ones that he had done. He hadn't raped the girls.
Right.
And the murders were not particularly violent.
Right.
Just like these weren't. These girls weren't stabbed. They weren't beaten to death or anything. They were usually just strangled or drowned or, right. you know, something like, not that that's not horrible enough on its own.
Right. Yeah.
But I'm just saying, you know, they weren't like cut up or anything like that, like Jack the Ripper would have done. So they thought that was kind of significant. But like I said, they're not sure if he was involved either. So to this day, the identity of Jack the Stripper is unknown. And it is unknown if the first two murders of Gwyneth Rees and of Elizabeth Figg were committed by the same guy. Right. If they were committed, like I said, these were all prostitutes.
Out of the two...
It could have been any number of people.
Right. Out of the two that you talked most about, I'd probably say it was Mungo.
That does seem like... I mean, the paint seems kind of damning.
That would be enough to get a conviction in the United States.
Yeah, and paint. The fact that he killed himself after... He didn't confess to the murders in the letter or anything like that.
Right.
But the fact that two or three of the victims were found with this particular paint on their skin...
He thought they were going to get it.
And he worked there.
He thought he was...
That really does kind of seem...
He thought he was done for.
Suspicious.
So he killed himself to save face.
I'm kind of leaning toward that as well.
Yeah.
Because that really does seem like the most damning piece of evidence in that case. Now, this next one, this guy, probably one of Scotland's best known serial killers, still unknown. He killed, as far as they know, unless it's who they think it might be, he only killed three women. Now, these women were not prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
The weird thing about this guy, though, is that all three of the women were taken from the same nightclub.
Huh.
At different times.
Okay.
So this is the case of Bible John.
Okay.
And you'll know why. They didn't start calling him that until the third murder, and I'll tell you
why. Right.
So this actually, this case began in February of 1968. This happened in Glasgow, Scotland. Now, apparently in the late 60s in Glasgow, a whole bunch of like dance halls and nightclubs opened. And I saw a documentary about it where they were saying Glasgow went dance mad. So February 1968, there's this 25-year-old nurse. Her name is Patricia Docker. And she and her husband, Alex, had just split up. She had moved back in with her parents. She had a 4-year-old kid, but she left him with the sitter one night. She's like, I'm going to go out dancing. So she told her parents that this was going to be a problem later on. She told her parents that she was going to a place called the Majestic Ballroom, which was kind of the more upscale, you know, dance hall in the area.
Right.
But she actually ended up going to the Barrowlands Ballroom, which was a lot more downmarket, shall we say. They're not really sure if she went to the Majestic first and then went to the Barrowlands, or if she was just intending to go to the Barrowlands, but she just didn't want to tell her parents. They're like, man, don't go to that fucking sketchy place. Yeah, but that's where she went. She evidently met someone there that killed her.
Oh, yeah.
Because the next morning, which was February 23rd, there's a guy named Morris Goodman, and he's cutting through a back alley on his way to work, and he finds the naked, dead body of Patricia Docker, severely beaten, raped, strangled with her own stockings. She was found, this was the saddest part to me, her body was found less than 100 yards from her parents' house.
Damn.
Yeah, like in an alley. They never found her clothes. They found one shoe, which she was still wearing. Here was something, and this was going to be kind of a hallmark of all of these Bible John murders. They were all on their period.
Weird.
Yeah. And they would also, like, he would put, like, a pad, you know, like a maxi pad or something, like, on the body or by it.
Weird.
Yeah, it's like it was a fetish or something. Yeah, so they found...
how did he know?
Well, that's what I mean.
How did he select them? Those are totally random. Totally coincidence, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. Just really super weird. That's what I always thought, too. It's like, what, did he ask him or something? That seems a little creepy. But yeah, so they did find a maxi pad, like, near the body. Another thing that would happen a lot was that he would take their purses and he would dump all the shit out, like, all and scattered all around, but not really take anything.
Want to see what was in there, I guess.
Or he would take a few things and that's it. They dredged the River Cart, which was nearby. They did find a bracelet belonging to her, and they found the actual purse. But, you know, that was pretty much it. They never found her any clothes or anything like that. Now, because Patricia had told her parents that she was going to the Majestic Ballroom, They actually lost 3 days of investigation because they were investigating that place instead of
the
Barrowlands. And yeah, she wasn't there. And it didn't help that like somebody had come forward and go, oh yeah, I totally danced with her at the Majestic that night before coming out later and being like, oh, maybe that was another night. I don't remember. Right. So, you know, they kind of lost a lot of information because of that. You know, she wasn't going out expecting to get killed. She just, you know, wasn't her fault. So they really had nothing much to go on. Now, a few people said that they had seen her at the Barrowlands that night. They said, yeah, she was dancing with a few different guys. She was, you know, having a good time. They said one of the guys had red hair, which was kind of significant. But, you know, that was too vague. And they're like, okay, well.
Right.
So then nothing happens for a little while. The next thing that happened was August 15th, 1969, and almost the exact same situation. Jemima McDonald, she was 32 years old. She had also recently separated from her husband, and she was going to go dance at the Barrowlands, had left the kids with a sitter, and she's going to the Barrowlands. So she was seen at this particular dance hall around midnight. She left in the company of a tall, thin, well-dressed man with red hair and subsequently disappeared. The following day, her sister, whose name was Margaret, she starts hearing rumors around the neighborhood that some kids have been at some like abandoned building or something like that. And they're talking about a body. And so Margaret's kind of like, well, geez, I haven't heard from Jemima for a day or two.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to that abandoned building and check it out.
Yeah.
So she goes there and finds her sister's body.
Damn.
Which, why would you do that? Which I would think you would call the cops, but maybe she didn't think anything was, she thought they were
maybe they
joking.
Thought it was bullshit. Yeah.
Yeah. They thought it was just bullshit. Like it was stupid kid stories. So she found her sister's body in this abandoned building. So also, like the previous victim, had also been raped, beaten, and strangled with her own stockings. Although she was not found naked, she was found fully clothed. She was also on her period. And also same thing with her purse being dumped out and scattered all around. Now, the third murder happened on Halloween night, 1969. And this was 29-year-old Helen Puttock. Now, her and her sister, whose name is Jean McLaughlin, they went dancing at the Barrowlands ballroom. Now, even though these murders had taken place in Glasgow, so, you know, the nightclub scene had kind of diminished a little bit, obviously, because women didn't really want to go out by themselves. So there's this, this weirdo running around. But, you know, they were still like, oh, it'll be okay. They were together. So the two of them went out. And what ended up happening, and this was actually where they got most of the information and why they ended up calling him Bible John, which I'll get to in a minute. So the two sisters are at the Barrowlands. They meet two guys at the bar. They both say their name is John. One of them says he's from Castle Milk, which is a district in, I believe it's in the southern part, the south of Glasgow. The other one didn't say where he was from. So the four of them kind of drank and dance and have a good time. They all left as a group. Now, the guy that said he was from Castle Milk, he's like, well, I got to skate. I got to go get a bus. So he goes to get a bus home. Now, the other three, the two sisters and this other John, they get a cab. And they're in this cab all together and they're talking. So they're going to go to Jean's house first, which was in this a neighborhood called Knightswood. Now, this taxi ride was 20 minutes long. Jean is talking to this guy. He said his name was John. She said his last name sounded like Templeton or Simpleson. That's what he said his name was. She said he's about in his late 20s, about 29 years old, very tall, very slender, light reddish hair. And this is a similar description to the man that had been seen with Jemima McDonald. She said that he was very polite, that he was very well spoken, that he was a little snotty, though, a little uptight.
Yeah.
Quoted from the Bible
a lot.
He allegedly told them that nightclubs were dens of iniquity.
Oh, here we go.
And he called them adulterers.
Oh.
Even though, because they were out dancing, even though they were separated from their husbands. They technically weren't divorced, but they were separated. And, you know, so he talked about all this kind of Bible-y shit. Now, so the cab stops in front of Jean's house and she gets out, leaving her sister Helen and this dude in the cab alone. Taxi takes off. Jean never sees her sister again. Next morning, Helen's body was found in a back garden of a flat on Earl Street, again, only 100 yards away from her own house. She had also been raped, strangled with her own stockings, contents of her handbag scattered near the remains, though the purse itself was never found. She was also on her period. The murderer had tucked a sanitary napkin under her arm, and he had bitten her leg. There was a big bite mark on her leg. So
is he walking them home and then attacking them before they get there?
Yeah, I'm thinking that's probably what it is. And that's probably what happened in this. They were both in a cab together, and she's probably like, oh, my house is just here. Yeah. Oh, I'll get out with you.
And then you have a situation where they're all on the rag.
Yeah. Which to me, that's really weird.
Could it be that under certain circumstances, if they're not on the reg, he lets them go?
Yeah, he could be following. He could be following people home all the time,
right?
And then seeing if they're on the rag,
right?
And then
if they say that they're on a rag or something like that, or because,
like I said, it would seem weird, like meeting somebody in a bar and being like, "Hey,
and it somehow triggers his fetish," or
and
something.
Then like having a stranger like ask you if you're on the rag, especially in 1968. I feel like that would be a little. It's creepy now.
There's got to be some kind of a weird way that a dude can detect it. You know what I mean? There's some kind of weird fetishist way. Maybe he actually looks in her purse while she's not looking.
To see
looking
if she has any pads.
If she has those in there.
Oh, that's a good idea. I didn't think of that.
He does it while, you know, her head is turned. He somehow
looks in her purse. Yeah, because it definitely does seem... I mean, like I said, that would be really random if you just pick three chicks from a bar and they were all on their period. That's
must be
weird.
He checks the purse first.
Yeah.
And if he finds napkins in there... He goes for it. If there's no napkins, he doesn't go after that one.
Yeah.
Something like that. It might be something like that. Something that we're taking for granted. He knows beforehand.
Right. So this killer, who they ended up calling Bible John because of what Gene McLaughlin had said about all the Bible quotes and everything like that, these are the three canonical Bible John murders.
Yeah.
Okay. Although one of the main suspects for this that, you know, they're not 100% sure, but that it probably could be him, is actually a serial killer who got convicted for some other shit later on. And they think that this is maybe some of his earlier crimes. And that guy's name was Peter Tobin. Peter Tobin is still alive.
Okay.
He's serving a whole life sentence in Scotland for some shit he pulled much later on. Now, things pointing to maybe him being Bible John. The sexual assaults and murders that he was convicted of. He actually wasn't convicted until 2006. And the span of sexual assaults and murders that they think was him spanned from 91 to 2006. But he was already a little bit older in 1991, older than generally a serial killer would start.
Right.
So they kind of think that maybe the Bible John murders were like his early like practice run type of murders. So they did think that Peter Tobin had lived in Glasgow around 1968, 1969. Apparently, he met his first wife at the Barrowlands Ballroom, right? In 1969, after he met her, he moved away. So that might have explained why there were only three quote-unquote Bible John murders, because he moved away with his first wife. Now, he was married three times. All three of his wives said that he had beat them and raped them on several occasions. Also, the interesting fact that he was driven into violent rages by women's menstrual cycles.
Hmm.
Like it was a weird thing that he had.
Right.
All of his wives said that.
Right.
Evidently. So later on, there was something in 2006, the UK police or whatever, they started a thing called Operation Anagram. Because they figured, look, this Tobin dude is suspected of so many crimes. He committed so many rapes and murders in this particular period. There have to be other murders that he's associated with that are unsolved.
Yeah.
So they did. They had this massive task force and everything like that. And they said, we're going to try and tie him to some of this unsolved shit that looks similar to his MO. So while they were doing that, they actually got a DNA sample from Helen Puddock's stockings and they compared it to his DNA. But the results were inconclusive. The DNA that they got from her stockings was too degraded. So the thing about it, though, even though it does kind of sound like it's probably him, and I am kind of leaning toward it maybe being him, it should be noted that Jean McLaughlin, Helen Puddock's sister, the one who rode in the cab with the killer, she said, that's not him.
Right.
Although, like I said, he was a lot older when he got arrested. And he did kind of look like he had red hair.
Yeah.
And he did kind of, when he was young, he did kind of look like a lot of the paintings and shit that were done of Bible John. So it's still possible that it was him. Also, he went by under a bunch of aliases. And one of his aliases was John Semple, which sounds like Sempleson or Templeton, which is what Gene McLaughlin had said his name was. But like I said, she said, I'm pretty sure that wasn't the guy that was in this cab with us. So who knows? She actually died in 2010. So that kind of line of inquiry is gone. And most of the DNA that they've got from the Bible John murders is not good enough to compare with his DNA.
So the Bible John cases may be part of Templeton. Is that his name?
Yeah, Templeton or Sempleton or whatever. Oh. Well, it's Peter Tobin's the name of the
case. Tobin, that's what I'm talking about. Those may be Tobin murders.
They might be.
Okay, because that actually sounds kind of more likely. That way, the whole menstruation angle is really just something that happened by chance because there were other victims that were not on it. Now, if menstruation had something to do with this, you know, modus operandi, he would have to know beforehand. My explanation is while they're in the club, he's reaching into her purse in the darkness and feeling around inside her purse. That could be one. Or he's looking in there. And then if he finds napkins, he targets her. If he doesn't find napkins, he doesn't. Maybe. Although it could just be statistical. Might have been part of a larger murder spree. And they're just grouping these together because napkins were involved.
Yeah, because these three were almost identical. And they were all the victims were taken from the same place. That's where they were last seen.
And your witness may have been drunk. That may have been Tobin. She just maybe too inebriated to ID him.
Right. And like I said, when he was convicted, you know, he was convicted much later on and he was much older. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's possible that she didn't recognize him because maybe he had, aged weird or something like that.
Yeah.
So Operation Anagram, even though it's not going full throttle right now, he has actually been exonerated of a few of the unsolved murders that they thought were associated with him. But there are still 9 unsolved murders in the UK that they think might have been him that they're trying to tie him to. You know, but the Bible John murders are not definitively them.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is that Helen's, the third victim, Helen Puttick, her husband, George, he seems to think that Helen Puttick was killed by the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, who we also did a show about. He was actually convicted of 13 murders. First one that they know of took place in 1975.
Now, why does he think that, though?
See, I'm not really sure. And I don't think the investigators are all that into it either. I think it's because of the bite mark.
I don't know.
So, I don't know. The MO doesn't sound real similar. But for some reason, he thinks that. But I don't think any investigators are kind of down with that. But again, I'm kind of leaning toward it being Bible John. Because the only reason to not think that is because Gene McLaughlin was like, hey, I rode in the cab with the dude and I don't think it's him. But like I said, that was a long time ago.
Right.
So everything else seems to point to him. And he sounds like, you know, he's a piece of shit. He's still alive. Like I said, he's still in a prison in Glasgow. But they're never letting his ass out because he was ultimately convicted of 3 murders. But they think he did a shit ton of other ones. So I guess we've gone like kind of over again, like we've
been,
not as much as I thought we would. Right. But I think I got most of the stuff in that I wanted to get in about these 2 serial killers. So hope you have enjoyed this again, extra long episode about murders and movies and all the usual digressions we usually take. Getting tased for Jesus and whatnot.
It's all good.
It's all good.
It's all good.
So remember, if you like the show, remember to like, share, subscribe, and share on all your social media. Tell all your friends and recommend us to other people who you think may be into this kind of thing. And if you'd like to financially support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/13oclockpodcast. Or if you would rather give a one-time donation through PayPal, you can go to our blog, which is 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com, and there's a link in the sidebar to a PayPal account. Also, remember to check out our last movie review, which was Phantasm. And also check out our t-shirts and tote bag that are available on our Zazzle store, which is zazzle.com/13oclock. And that will do it for episode 88 about Jack the Stripper and Bible John. We will see you next time. Bye.